From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, do sky-high gas prices mean boffo box office? Plus, first there was the writer's strike, and now there's strike TV. And the zen of making movie titles. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Go nowhere. It's The Business from NPR. Bad news for internet pirates and their ill-gotten booty, me hearties. Last week, a judge ruled that Google will have to turn over user information for every video watched on YouTube to Viacom, which sued for $1 billion over copyright violations in March of last year. Viacom hopes to show that the infringing material is more popular than user-created videos, which could increase Google's liability in the case. Speaking of copyright violations, it turns out that the new Disney Pixar movie star is a film pirate himself, and we have the footage to prove it. As Canadian blogger Jesse Willis noted after watching WALL-E last week, the lovable little robot is actually a hardened criminal, at least as defined by Canadian copyright law. Among his violations documented in the film, WALL-E records audio from his favorite movie, Hello, Dolly, onto his own digital video recorder. He then watches pirated video and then even shares the music with another robot pal. Upon his arrest by Canadian Mounties, WALL-E had this to say. Jeez, that robot has some mouth on him. Elsewhere, from Canadian Borders to Borders Bookstores, which may be getting into the movie business. The number two U.S. bookstore chain has just taken an option out on Tom Evitable's unpublished new novel, The Eighth Day. Borders will publish it this summer through a year-old in-house publishing arm called, you guessed it, Borders Books. A company spokeswoman told Variety last week that Borders would, quote, be a catalyst for getting the movie made, unquote, but stopped short of saying that they'd launch a film division. Though it's worth noting that Borders Group CEO George Jones is the former president of worldwide licensing and retail for Warner Brothers. You do the math. Finally, a judge has granted actor Wesley Snipes permission to travel abroad to work while he fights tax convictions which could land him in jail for 3 years. Snipes has now been approved to spend 8 weeks in Bangkok to shoot Chasing the Dragon and will then fly to London for 3 days later this month to finish work on the oh-so-aptly titled Gallo Walker. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later in the show, will Hollywood get a bump from the economic slump? But next, TV goes on strike. TV. During their strike earlier this year, a number of film and TV writers got together to make web videos to more or less keep themselves busy. After all, you can only eat so many donuts. Their stuff was scheduled to debut on a new website called Strike TV this Independence Day, a day rich in meaning for these writers who will finally own their work. Now that more than half the country has high-speed internet, Strike TV could be the real deal. Many contributors are big-time writers on shows like The Office, The Daily Show, Jimmy Kimmel Live, and the site is in negotiations for big brand sponsorships. With an actor's strike still a possibility, the new online venture could also lend some extra leverage to their thespian friends. Steven D'Souza is the screenwriter of movies like Die Hard and Lara Croft Tomb Raider, The Cradle of Life, and he's launching a new series on Strike TV. Steve D'Souza, welcome to The Business.
Thank you very much, Claude.
So what is Strike TV, first of all?
Well, Strike TV was inspired during the strike by, I guess, a lot of idle people sitting around. And
Writers, mainly,
but also people from the other unions, but driven by the Writers Guild. And they'd all seen, I guess, those Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland movies where they say, hey, let's put on a show.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the thinking. Why don't we put on a show? I mean, you know, make original material for the internet, get an interim agreement. So they got all the unions to agree on an interim agreement that would be the model for, you know, future original material for the web, and recommended people defer salaries if they were so minded, And then the different producers who are interested in using this outlet, you know, sort of finance these things out of their own pocket or their credit cards, like filmmakers going to the Slam Dance Film Festival.
Mm-hmm. So what are you doing here?
You know, back in the 20th century, weird stories came to us from the Twilight Zone. It was up there in the sky with the door.
Do not adjust your sets.
Or the Outer Limits. Perfect, yeah. So where do weird things come from in an internet era? Well, we both know the answer to that question because we've seen those things in our email box. They come from the unknown sender. So that's the name of my show, and it's like Twilight Zone meets Alfred Hitchcock with the Little Mad magazine.
Mm-hmm.
This can be a great incubator and a launching pad.
Well, let me inject a note of skepticism here. I mean, what do you think your chances are with this realistically? I mean, a lot of people would say this is just a lark. It's just, you know, Steve D'Souza has 10 minutes to himself during a strike. Why not do a vanity project or something
No, you're absolutely right. And on a certain degree, it was a lark. And I wasn't the only one who felt that. Timothy Dalton and Joanna Whalley, Timothy was James Bond, and the two of them were Rhett and Scarlett in the miniseries. These people, it was like Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland. People were exhilarated because we could, you know, play in six sandboxes. We actually did six episodes in a marathon. So
and financed all through your own MasterCard.
Yes, and at a cost 1,000 times less than my next film.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of talk is about whether or not we're going to have a strike from the actors. If we do, do you think that'll help this venture?
Yeah, in a bizarre way. I, at the risk of sounding like McCain's advisor, who said, you know, actually, disaster would be great for us. Another work stoppage would at least have all this talent a phone call away.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, at the risk of sounding too cheeky here, I hope you don't take this the wrong way. But what's really the difference between Steve D'Souza and some kid, you know, who's got a water skiing squirrel or, you know, getting kicked in the nuts by his friend on YouTube? I mean, to kids online, they don't care that you wrote Die Hard or 48 Hours or Tomb Raider. They only see video. They see it's funny. It's not funny. How does this get marketed? How did we even know that this is out there?
Well, I mean, that was one of the things that they said, leave to us, the Strike TV guys. And I know that they've already gotten some major advertisers on this website.
How now, major? Like extends male enhancement, or like Procter & Gamble?
I believe they have Disney. I believe they have Coke. And all the revenue for the first 3 months is going to people in all of the unions who had financial hardship during the strike. So is that the reason Coke is there? Is that the reason Disney is there? Or do they actually think there may be eyeballs on this?
Well, we'll find out soon. Steve D'Souza is the writer of movies like Die Hard, 48 Hours, and Lara Croft, Tomb Raider, The Cradle of Life. And he's the creator of a new series for the web called, Steve?
Unknown Sender.
Unknown Sender, that will appear on Strike TV. Steve, thanks for being on The Business.
All right, thank you.
You are not going to believe what is happening.
This summer, the writers of Die Hard, Tomb Raider, The Daily Show, The Office, General Hospital, Family Guy, Friends, Jimmy Kimmel Live, Frasier, Lonely Girl 15, Child's Play, Star Trek, Malcolm in the Middle, 48 Hours, Robot Chicken, 30-something, The Elder, The Santa Claus, Spunky, The Mike Stallion, Farsky, Family Ties, Papers, Adventure, Golden State.
Oh, come on! This is ridiculous!
And the $6 Million Man present the first network.
You lying slut.
What the hell is that supposed to mean?
That gives creative freedom.
Mommy.
To the creators.
Ooh, sounds dangerous.
Introducing Strike TV. www.strike.tv.
All right.
Last year's summer box office was the best ever in terms of ticket sales, thanks to monster hits like Spider-Man 3, Pirates of the Caribbean 3, and Shrek the Third. With titles and grosses like those, no one expected this year to top it. But even with skyrocketing gas prices and home foreclosures and all the rest, or perhaps because of them, we're on track for another boffo blockbuster season. In fact, this June's box office alone is up 17% compared to last June. Iron Man is on pace to beat the numbers for Indiana Jones. Sex and the City and The Happening did way better than anyone thought they would. And now WALL-E, Wanted, Get Smart, Kung Fu Panda, Don't Mess with the Zohan, Hancock, and The Hulk. They're all pulling down big numbers, and there's even more big titles coming down the pike, like Hellboy 2 and Batman The Dark Knight. We can only say, ka-ching! Pam McClintock writes for Variety. Her June 27th piece in Weekly Variety was entitled Hollywood Gets Bump from Slump, Summer Box Office on the Rise. Pam McClintock, welcome to The Business.
Thank you.
So what's the headline here? You just wrote a piece in Variety sort of talking about the economy. Tell us the headline exactly.
Well, I think the headline is that, you know, I think there's evidence that as the economy and gas troubles grow, you know, movies are becoming a popular getaway. Because essentially, you know, I think there's an argument to be made that people aren't traveling as much this summer because of the skyrocketing gas prices.
And the summer of the staycation.
Exactly, the summer of the staycation. You know, and as much as we all grouse about how much movies cost and concessions, you know, the bottom line is it's cheaper than going to other places, such as a theme park or, you know, or out of town.
Mm-hmm. So what's the most surprising part of the data that you've analyzed here? I mean, is there an area that's doing well that shocked you?
Well, I think what shocked me the most was realizing that just as gas prices went over, the nationwide average went over $4 was just when we saw the box office start to take off at the beginning of June. Now, I'm not saying that's an absolute science because it's not, but I think it's very interesting.
Now, it's no secret that in sort of rough times, DVD and well, in the past, VHS rentals would go up. You know, people would sit home and make it a blockbuster night, so to speak. But is it surprising to you that the box office has gone up markedly as well?
Well, not really, because, you know, at some point people want to get out of their house, especially if you have kids. So I think, you know, I don't think people just want to stay home 24/7. And, you know, a lot of people are predicting that DVD sales will be strong this summer. We haven't seen as much evidence of that as of yet.
In some respects, maybe, is this a red herring that, you know, really the issue is box office is up, but could it simply be that the movies are just better this summer?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's no question that most films are working. I mean, look at Sex and the City. You know, no one thought women could open a film that big and get that kind of gross. Or The Happening, which no one expected to do as well as it did.
You're talking about M. Night Shyamalan's movie.
Yes.
Yeah, and there's a new blockbuster around the corner that we've got Will Smith showing up in a new superhero movie, which is called?
Hancock.
And how's it doing? What are the preliminaries?
Well, Sony last night began showing the film at 7 p.m., which, you know, has become a popular way to kind of get half a day's grosses into your full gross. So the movie did about $6.7 million last night, which is really good. I mean, I think Iron Man did about $5.5 million in its previews. And then last summer, Transformers did about $8.8 million. So, it, you know, Transformers had the advantage of being a more recognizable brand than Hancock.
Mm-hmm. But the point here is basically by just sort of dipping the toe in the water to gauge the temperature, the water's pretty bubbly warm.
Yes, the water's definitely bubbly warm and very inviting.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing I'd love to do is just sort of set the Wayback Machine to the 1970s for a moment, back when we had gas rationing and wide ties and sideburns and stagflation. How was the movie business doing back then?
You know, I think in the 70s it was very different because you didn't have so many theaters, you didn't have multiplexes, and the way the business worked was you opened your big movie in a downtown theater and, you know, there were lines around the block. So, you know, if you got in your car, you drove downtown, there might be a chance you're not even going to get into the theater, which means you have to turn around and drive back home. You burned up gas and you didn't see the movie. And now it's entirely different. There's a multiplex on every corner, so to speak, and with a big movie playing on multiple screens. Now you go to a big multiplex with a big parking lot, and it's much easier.
Now, there's been a trend towards sort of the high-end table service of theaters, you know, theaters that offer wine bars and Chateaubriand along with your movie nachos. How is that doing? I mean, is that area sort of taking off or taking a hit?
Well, as you probably know, theater owners will never talk about financials, and I think we have to remember that some of the higher-end theaters, they're showing, you know, more art house fare, which I don't think is taking off right now to the same degree that more commercial movies are.
Mm-hmm.
For its own set of reasons. I mean, I think right now we're seeing kind of a boom on the more popcorn movie side or more broadly playing films.
Now, you mentioned earlier that movies are sort of a cheaper bet than theme parks. And theme parks are actually reducing their ticket prices pretty dramatically. I think Six Flags is dropping them down by 50%, 2-for-1 kind of stuff at a lot of its places, or shaving $25 off admission, that kind of
mm-hmm.
thing. I'm wondering if given the economy, this sort of, you know, malaise that is hitting people both in gas prices, falling home prices, are the theaters and studios doing anything differently to capitalize on that sort of economic malaise? You know, are they marketing different? Are ads acknowledging anything about the larger economy? Are they improving customers? Is there anything that they have to do or feel like they want to do to capitalize on this?
If they are, I don't know about it yet. I mean, I think even they're surprised by the strength of the box office.
Mm-hmm. We talk about this as flush times for the Wall Street overlords who oversee these multimedia companies. But the truth is, if you get on the phone to agents at William Morris or CIA or ICM, there's a lot of Prozac being consumed. There's a lot of tumbleweeds in the hallways, especially among talent agents, because we've got kind of a de facto strike going on. I'm wondering how, when you write these kinds of stories, how is it received by a town that is going to get lousy bonuses, if any, and is walking around, you know, in a Prozac haze?
Well, at least it's some good news for them. You know, it's certainly, you're right, there's so much pressure on the studios right now. You know, on the film side, all these productions, you know, are grinding to a halt and because of the de facto strike. So I guess it's like a sliver of good news, but it certainly doesn't make up the whole picture.
Well, we got to leave it there. Pam McClintock is a reporter at Variety. She joined us by phone from their offices. Pam, thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks, you guys.
Directors are, by necessity, control freaks. And yet they usually farm out the very first scene of their movies, the main title sequence. Now, that made sense back when titles were nothing more than words crawling up the screen. But now they're a major budget line item, sometimes costing in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. They may involve live-action shoots and sophisticated animation, and they can get a film off to a fast start by giving story and character exposition. We'll leave the fascinating history of titles for another time and skip to a modern-day example of the state-of-the-art. Kung Fu Panda is the latest film from DreamWorks Animation, and it actually ends with an elaborate 8-minute end title sequence created by the design firm Shine.
Everybody is kung fu fighting. Your mind becomes fast as lightning.
John Stevenson was the co-director of Kung Fu Panda, and Michael Riley is the creative director of Shine. Let's start with Michael here. I want to get just a quick laundry list from you of what are the plates, you know, chainsaws and bowling balls that you're juggling as you design a title. What I mean,
yeah. Well,
there's legal, obviously.
There's the legal list. How many names do we have? In this case, you know, almost 1,000 names. I mean, that there are quite a lot. We'd want to know, is this going to be something that's going to work with their live action footage? Is it going to be over their scene or is it a sequence that's unto itself? But more importantly, we're interested in knowing what kind of function it needs to serve in terms of story. Is there some story that needs to be told at the beginning of the film? Is there a mood that needs to be set up? Is there some sort of a story that needs to be told at the end? Are there some sort of questions or is there some sort of mystery that the director wants to set up in the beginning of the film before you get into the story? We need to know all of the sort of details behind what this title sequence is supposed to do. We need to know about music. There may be a predetermined track. It may be the composer on the film that's already done something. It may be that they want it silent or sound design might be part of it. It could be that there's a special song that they've decided to put over the title sequence. We also would like to know just the tone. What is the director looking for? What's the direction of the film? What's the mood of the film? Usually in the beginning of the process, we'll either be given a script or we'll see a rough cut either in the editing suite or they'll send us a DVD. And so we'll see what the movie's about and we'll have some ideas of our own even in the first meeting with the filmmakers. In general, we just want to know how is the title sequence supposed to function and what purpose does it serve in the film and how can and what are what kinds of solutions could we bring to the table that would somehow solve that challenge and communicate that story.
Coming up after a short break, more title talk with the co-director and title designer of Kung Fu Panda. You're listening to The Business from NPR. Listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. During a movie's main title sequence, you may be scooching over into your seat with your arms full of snacks, and you may be walking out as the end credits roll. But next time you're at the movies, stop and pay attention. A huge amount of time, money, and creativity went into those bookends. For instance, John Stevenson, the co-director of DreamWorks Animation's new film Kung Fu Panda, told us that their elaborate 8-minute end sequence was the most expensive title role the studio had ever made. Of course, this being Hollywood, contractual obligation comes before creative genius. We're talking to director John Stevenson and Michael Riley, the creative director of Shine, the company that created the titles for Kung Fu Panda. Specifically with Kung Fu Panda, what were there any legal issues? Like, you know, with Jack Black, did his name have to be a certain size?
All of the titles had to be the same size in this case because they all had to be tied to the size of the director's credit. So in each case...
Is that normal?
That's typically the case. Usually you get a legal title list and it has a list of everyone's name and what size their name needs to be in relation to either the director's credit or the main title of the movie. And you look at the list and there may be some leeway. For instance, say costume designer casting might be able to be a little bit smaller than, say, your main talent credit. It really varies depending on the film, depending on the talent, depending on the studio.
There was a very particular challenge with Kung Fu Panda because we opted to have lateral scrolling type, you know, scrolling from right to left. So that actually presented some very particular timing challenges for Michael in terms of the speed so that the type would not strobe, that we could actually read it, and to contain these like 900-some names in the time that we had allowed. So there was actually a pretty huge technical challenge to have our type move in a way that usually you don't see on movies. That Shine did an amazing job in doing that, and it was a bit of a struggle at some points where we were wondering, will this ever work? We want to do this kind of bold new thing, which will hopefully make our title stand out. But maybe it'll actually sort of do the opposite effect and make everything that we're trying to do in terms of recognizing people just unreadable.
Right to left because the Chinese characters are written right to left, right?
Yes, indeed. And yeah. We wanted to use it was an idea that Shine presented that the credits would actually be in an unfurling scroll, since the scroll is a big part of our story.
John, how did you articulate all this? Is it by email? Is it in a room?
No.
Are you sitting there saying, I want this but not that?
Yeah.
How much guidance are you giving at the outset?
It really was just sitting down face-to-face because I don't believe you can do this stuff through email or over the phone. It's much better to actually be there, show art, say, like this, not like this. Do you have any questions? You know, let's do it now. And in fact, one of the things we did that was good and smart and I think had a lot of benefits was we, at a certain point, it made sense for Shine to move in to the studio, and we put them in our hub, which is sort of where all our artistic supervisors were. So they were literally, you know, in an office down the hall from the production
designer. Camped out with sleeping bags and getting it done.
Pretty much. And it was very nice that they were prepared to do that.
Is that unusual?
I don't know. We've never done it before, so it was a first for us. But it seemed to be good, so I'd recommend it for anybody who's listening.
I've never gone over to a studio to work on a title sequence. This was the first time I had done something like this.
Michael, I mean, you know, so much of the great movie title sequences that we now all remember simply because they were so innovative. I'm thinking of, Wayne Fitzgerald designing the opening sequence for Bonnie and Clyde or mm-hmm. Saul Bass doing, you know, movies like Vertigo or Psycho mm-hmm. that just the moment you the first frame rolls through the projector, you know that this is sort of an iconic film and an iconic title sequence, too. How do you balance having sort of a creative stable of guys who are trying to push the limits of whatever design they can do? Or do you literally have to just sit there and say, you know what, it might be fun to try this, but...
I think that all of those title designers that you just suggested in those instances obviously came to the table with not just what the director said, but tried to bring something else to the table. And in those particular instances, they were things that hadn't been seen before. But I do think that if you were to look at each one of those films, you would say, hey, this is a title sequence that definitely works with this story and for these reasons. And I think it's as simple as that.
Now, the problem that you face as a designer is that often movie titles are not considered a fixed cost. They're a variable cost. In the end, we can just put up white title cards if it comes to that. Maybe we don't want that. That's not perfect, but we can do it that way. How does that affect what you do?
We usually know ahead of time if the budget is a little bit challenged, and we'll be thinking that we'll kind of have that in the back of our minds when we're designing.
You know, we knew from the outset, you know, right, you know, going back years on Kung Fu Panda, that we were going to have great looking main titles and end titles. That was just a decision we'd made. So there was always like, put a big pot of money away somewhere for that, because that is something that's very important to us. We don't want to suddenly, you know, be in that situation that you just talked about and to cheap out and have just scrolling, you know, white type on black.
Last thing I want to ask you, and I'll ask it to Michael, but if you have thoughts on this, John, I'd love to hear them from you as well. You know, it was at the end of a movie, and I'm thinking especially of these sort of old-timey studio pictures from, you know, back in the day, you know, the 40s, the 50s. The movie ended, and then there was a sort of idiot card that said, by the way, the end. What happened to the end?
Well, let me just say that we actually did have the end in our title sequence, and it was the first credit at the very end of the film.
Because we're idiots.
we did that.
The reason we did it, we put up a Chinese character that said the end, and then we actually decided we needed to write the end in English on top of it so everybody would understand what that was.
But just from an aesthetic standpoint, I'm wondering, do you have an opinion on this? Like, is it that audience is like just more sophisticated now, or like what happened to the end? I don't know. Is an okay answer too.
I actually have no idea. actually, Kung Fu Panda is the first time I've actually done a card that says the end. So I don't really know.
The other one thing that occurred to me that I'd like to ask Michael is, it would seem like the worst thing that ever happened to the title design business is that movies wound up being put on television. That in the end, all this stuff is just going to get squished anyway. So who the hell cares what it looks like?
The idea that titles end up being on television is actually a consideration that you have to think about when you're producing your title sequence, because a film screen is very wide and then your television is less so. So you may have to design for that, thinking ahead that, okay, when this is broadcast on one of the networks, the titles will have to be legible, visible, we'll have to work creatively in some way. We like to know ahead of time, you know, how will the translation on television be handled? Will it be something that's just cut out of the middle? Do we make a special version for television?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you have to think about that ahead of time, because it is a consideration and it's dealt with differently on every project.
Well, we'll leave it there. My guests were John Stevenson, who co-directed Kung Fu Panda with Mark Osborne, and Michael Riley, who's the creative director of Shine. It's a creative design and production studio specializing in branding, storytelling for the entertainment and advertising industries. And, of course, they do tons of titles for movies and TV, including the title sequence for Kung Fu Panda. John, Michael, thanks for being on The Business.
Thank you so much. It was a great pleasure being here.
Thank you for having us.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.